From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation or around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the ET intervention and reincarnation with Paul Von Ward. Get ready for that. Here's what's happening. Well, we lost the modern era Thomas Edison, Steve Jobs, the co-founder of Apple, who introduced simple, well-designed computers for people who were more interested in what technology could do than how it was done, has died at the age of 56. In a very brief statement, Apple announced the death but did not say where he died. Mr. Jobs, who suffered from a very rare form of pancreatic cancer and had a liver transplant in 2009, had just stepped down as Apple's chief executive on August 24th. How ironic, with the brand new Apple iPhone coming out, that he would pass. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, is with us and has been following this story all day. This is a very sad story, Stephen. This is Leo. Stephen was one of a kind.
Yeah, and it's hard to think of who is going to take his place. You know, he brought a lot of excitement, a lot of vision, a lot of passion to technology, and I think changed our lives. I bet many of your listeners have an Apple product. If it's not in their pocket, it's on their desk. He really changed everything.
I sensed when he stepped down, something was wrong. Did you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He said in his resignation that he'd always said if he couldn't run the company, he would get out of the way. And I think it was pretty clear that he'd come to the last few months of his life. We didn't know, and we hoped for the best, but I'm afraid the worst came true.
56 years old, Leo. That's young.
It's just 2 years older than me, but, you know, there's something to celebrate here, too. This guy got a lot done in his life. His partner, Steve Wozniak, who founded Apple with him, said Steve accomplished everything he had set his mind to do. He got what he wanted, and I think it's a life of great accomplishment and a life we can celebrate.
Will Apple ever be the same? Will it lose totally that creative influence that Steve Jobs had? Or I would assume it's got some pretty good people there.
You know, they say that Steve's left his DNA at Apple and he's trained these people, and I think that that's true. He surrounded himself with good people, but you've got to remember, there's only one Steve Jobs. There's only one Michelangelo, only one Henry Ford, only one Thomas Edison. When these guys move on, we can only say we were glad we were alive in their era. I don't think it's going to be the same for Apple ever again.
Those of us who lived during this era saw some history here, didn't we?
No kidding. We really did. He started the personal computer revolution. He started the smartphone revolution, the tablet revolution, the iPod revolution. This one guy did an awful lot.
He sure did. Leo, thank you so much. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Steve Jobs, dead at the age of 56. Protesters continue to gather for a march on New York's financial district, with rallies also planned now in several other cities. Occupy Wall Street organizers hope to attract thousands of people to rally in Lower Manhattan, having won the backing of powerful unions now. The demonstrations in their third week showing no signs of fading. They are growing. Registered investment advisor Ms. Shedlock with us. Ms., is this going to do anything? I mean, are they just going to protest, or is something going to be done with all this?
I don't think anything's going to be done. In fact, you know, they're protesting in the wrong places. You know, protesting against Wall Street. They should be protesting against government that enabled Wall Street to do these things, that bailed out the banks. To a certain extent, these protests we're seeing are a sign of frustration, and certainly that frustration is going to grow. We're seeing it, the same thing in Europe. In fact, I just wrote an article on my blog today to Chancellor Merkel and President Sarkozy of France, saying the extend and pretend session is over. You know, it's time to do or die. We either need to see, you know, Europe come up with a plan to recapitalize banks, to get Europe together, form a fiscal union, or we need to see a plan to break up the Eurozone, have Germany go on its own way, to let Greece go. They're trying to do this extend and pretend thing in Europe. We're trying to do this here in the United States. It's not working over there. It's not working over here. Meanwhile, I saw an interesting video today. It's going to be on my blog a little bit later tonight, where customers trying to get money out of Bank of America at a bank in St. Louis.
That's right. I know.
Could not get their. They wouldn't let these people go in and pull their money out. You know, what's up with that?
Well, and I also wanted to ask you, Bank of America has now gone 6 days with major website problems. Just tonight, they're blaming it on an upgrade that they say is only 60% complete. I think they're being hacked.
I don't know. I don't think they're being hacked. You know, the question is, are they doing this to prevent people from getting their money out? Whatever reason, they were certainly ill-prepared for the customer response that we've seen here. And if banks can't make money off of deposits, what does that say for the Fed policy? We have a Fed policy here that lowered interest rates to 0% to bail out the banks. But at 0%, the banks aren't paying anything on interest, and they're losing money on deposits.
And they're still losing money.
This is how screwed up Fed policy is. You know, by the way, I have to congratulate you. There was a tremendous interview on Jobs and Apple. I appreciated that. And but, you know, this economy, we need people like Jobs to get it going. I don't see where we have that talent not running in the Republican Party, not running in the Democrat Party. No one wants to step up to the plate and do the right thing.
I hear your mission. The one thing Stephen Jobs did do, in addition to many things, he created lots of jobs. NATO troops training in Turkey, apparently, for a Turkish-led NATO invasion of Syria. Could that be? A senior Syrian diplomat believes that's going on separately, and four Middle East security officials say Russia has been inspecting Syrian forces and has been advising Syria about possible Syrian military responses should NATO attack the regime of Syrian President Bashar Assad. Stand by and see what happens there. Assad has said that he will launch missiles into Israel if he's attacked. And a potentially crushing blow to the growing medical marijuana industry, the IRS has ruled that dispensaries cannot deduct standard business expenses such as payroll, security, or rent. Harborside Health Center, for example, one of the nation's largest medical marijuana dispensaries and considered a model for the industry, is now on the hook for $2.5 million in taxes from the years 2007 and 2008. That is $2 million more than the Oakland, California-based company paid for those tax years. The owner, the person who puts it together, says, look, this is not going to work for us if this happens. The ATF says medical marijuana patients are now prohibited from owning guns. That's right. They say that you cannot do it. It was a letter they sent out September 21st that clarifies that the Bureau includes medical marijuana patients in the group of prohibited buyers for handguns because their marijuana use is illegal federally. Remember the movie Open Water? A couple scuba divers were there and the boat left and they died? Well, that almost happened. A U.S. Coast Guard says it was investigating a Florida tourism company that left behind two tourists while they were scuba diving. The tourists, Paul Klein and Fernando Prata, were rescued by a private yacht which found them clinging to a buoy in a shark-infested waters. A motorist was caught driving while using a laptop, writing the answers to a quiz on a radio show, and drinking coffee all at the same time. He must have had three arms. The behavior was observed during a crackdown on distracted drivers by police in the United Kingdom. Other offenses they spotted, including a man eating a pear while driving with a knife, cutting the pear. Does Prozac make someone a killer? Well, it appears to be the first criminal case in North America where a judge has specifically found that an antidepressant was the cause of murder. We'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. One of our medical experts, Dr. Peter Bragan, Harvard-trained psychiatrist, former full-time consultant, private practice in Ithaca, New York. Dr. Bragan also acts as a medical expert in criminal malpractice, product liability, and legal cases. We're going to be talking about antidepressants and just what's going on in North America, specifically in Canada. Here's Dr. Peter Bragan back on Coast to Coast. This is an incredible case, Peter.
Yes, it is. It's a landmark case in North America. You know, we've had cases before where judges have approved the argument to the jury that antidepressants cause violence and suicide. And there have been product liability cases that have been won on the grounds that these drugs have caused violence and suicide. But we've never had a judge come flat out and say that, in this case, a 16-year-old boy was driven to violence by suicide, by Prozac, excuse me, by Prozac. It's a chilling case. The whole thing unfolds over only a three-month period. The young boy had just turned 16. He told his mom he was feeling depressed. She didn't notice that particularly that he was, but he said he wanted to see the doctor, and he went to the primary care doctor. All of this in the Winnipeg area of Canada, and the doc gave him a 20-milligram dose of Prozac, a typical starting dose for an adult, although it's not approved for children in Canada. And 9 days later, the tragedy begins to really unfold. The boy attempts to suicide on his grandfather's OxyContin.
Jeez.
Now, that should have been just a dead giveaway to any psychiatrist, because the times you tend to get suicide and violence are during dose changes, within a few days or weeks after a dose change, up or down. And usually it's a dose up that's going to cause the problem. The mom got really concerned, and the primary care doctor did. And he referred this 16-year-old to a very well-established local psychiatric clinic. And he sent along a note basically saying, question mark about him being on Prozac. So the primary was behaving really well about this, although we shouldn't have put him on it to begin with. Mom noted that she was having more mood swings on the Prozac, which is very, very common and is a bad sign. And he gets over to the clinic, and they don't change anything at all. They keep him on the Prozac.
Jeez.
Over the summer, George, he gets more irritable. He gets more angry. He gets agitated. He gets insomnia. He becomes impulsive, starts to do dangerous things, gets grandiose. He's threatening to people. He runs away from home at one point. He cuts himself. All new behavior. So on September 3rd of 2009, his parents bring him back to the clinic. They're very, very worried. And the boy thinks the Prozac's helping. He has no idea what's happening to him. I call that medication spellbinding. He has no idea. He's getting more agitated, more angry, that he's not himself anymore. And so what happens? The psychiatrist, instead of stopping the Prozac, doubles the dose. 17 days later, this young man is annoyed at his very close friends because they've had a little altercation with his brother, but nothing has come of it. There's been no aggression, no serious problems. And he invites his two friends over the house. They have a cigarette. They're sitting around smoking a cigarette in chairs next to each other. He pulls out a kitchen knife and one blow stabs his friend to death.
Jeez. And then he calls the police on himself.
That's right. He calls the police on himself. He says, I don't know why I did this. When somebody says to him, well, can you tell us more? He says, I just had to do it. He can't give an explanation. Now, typical of the psychiatric profession throughout the world, not just in Canada, of course, they keep him on the Prozac. So he goes through November and December in jail on the Prozac. He's kind of weirded out and doesn't relate to people much. And then he decides that he really needs to come off this, and he asks the jail to take him off, and they do. And people in the prison report this dramatic change in his character. I had a long interview. I was the expert on his side in the case, and I eventually met him and interviewed him. But in the beginning, I talked on the phone with him and with a counsel that he worked with, who said that this young man, now off his Prozac, was like no one else in the prison. He didn't belong in prison. He didn't look like a kid who should be in prison. The counselor said, I trust him out right now to leave the jail. Just gave him a 100% vote of confidence, which you almost never get from somebody who's got 20 years experience with the patient, inmates in these situations. And then we waited for the judge, and it's always hard to know just what a judge is going to say. They're under a lot of pressure by, if not directly the drug companies, and often it is directly the drug companies, they're under pressure from the psychiatric community and from, you never know from whom. But the judge recently came out with an opinion, and the extensively citing my testimony, he said that the evidence supported my view that this young boy, this young teenager, had gotten worse and worse on the Prozac, and then when his dose was doubled, he'd gotten worse and worse some more, and that this had led to the violence, and that without the drug, this violence probably would not have happened.
So what happened to the youngster?
Well, it's I think good news for him. The judge's opinion was in the context of a hearing to determine if the young man would be sentenced as an adult, which the prosecution wanted in Canada, which would mean that he could spend much of his life in jail for this violent murder. Or he'd be tried and sentenced as a youth, in which case it would be a 4 years maximum, and he'd already served well over a year of that. So the judge started out by saying that he's going to be sentenced as a youth, which means, less than 3 years to go now, and that he also, the judge, felt, again, along with my testimony, that this person did not have a perpetrator profile, which was part of my argument.
Prior to the Prozac, he was not dangerous.
This was not dangerous. He'd never done anything dangerous. He was just a good kid. So we're thinking that come November 4th, the judge is bound by law now. He can't keep him in jail for more than a few years more. And I'm guessing he's going to hear arguments from both sides. But I'm guessing and hoping the young man will be out within a relatively short time. And I hope with supervision. I maintain that he should have some supervision for quite a while because he has been through, a horrific experience.
Oh, my God. I mean, that's a different experience all by itself. He needs your services as a psychiatrist just for what he's been through.
Well, that's right. Or let's say a counselor. I'm a psychiatrist, but it could be a counselor or a psychologist, a social worker, somebody skilled in therapy. I specifically recommended against is being given any more psychiatric drugs.
Well, and the sad part about this, Peter, is there's a 16-year-old somewhere who's dead.
That's right. And a family that is just utterly grief-stricken. Really, two families, the one who lost their son to this horrendous and then the family and all the people connected to the young man who perpetrated this. And
Peter, well, will the 16-year-old, will he, when he gets out, he'll be 20. Will he really ever be the same?
I don't think so. I had another case that I describe in my book, Medication Madness, of a very sweet 16-year-old girl who was on Prozac for about a week and got a violent impulse to want to drive a knife into her mother's back.
Jeez.
And a very sweet girl. The only reason she'd been put on the Prozac is she'd been overseas. She'd gotten some gastrointestinal problem that nobody could diagnose, and it was just wearing her out a little. So Prozac was new, fairly new at that point. And he thought, well, doctor.
Give it to her, relaxer, right? That's what they do.
That's right. Help her with her anxiety or her tension or whatever. And she got this terrible compulsion. And as her mother was putting her to bed one night, she just confessed to her mother, I feel like I'm on the verge of killing you. And her mother, and it was with a knife again in her imagination, and her mother had the sense to say to herself, this is not my daughter.
There's something
wrong here. I wonder if it's
the
drug.
Yeah.
So she took her daughter to the primary care doc, who sent him to a psychiatrist, who in this case, and it's rare nowadays, it was more common a decade ago, who said, it's probably the Prozac that's causing this violent fantasy, take her off. Well, this is in response to your question. This person did not perpetrate the crime, yet when I interviewed her in her 30s, she still felt guilty,
yeah,
still felt traumatized just by the fantasy, the compulsion to do this, and was so relieved to talk to somebody after all this time from 16 to I think it was her early 30s, it's in the book, to talk to somebody who could tell her, no, this was not some evil thing in you. This happens to people all the time. And frequently, very frequently, after even one or two doses of these antidepressants, I got a case in Medication Madness of a man who drowned himself and his two children after his second dose of Paxil.
My God. Let's talk more about this, Peter, when we come back, and we'll take some phone calls. If you are on antidepressants and you want to share some of your stories, don't be shy. We'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Over the next 12 months, I'd like to add 1,000 new Coast Insiders to the club every month, and we are well on our way for this first month already, clipping along at a great pace. If you can dabble with less than 25 cents a day and you want to be a Coast Insider and get downloads, podcasting, and up to 1,000 shows you can download now, right away, you'll have some fun with that. In a week or so, we're going to play some little clips from Coast Insiders who are brand new, and they just enjoy this tremendously, and they'll tell you why. So all you have to do is go to coasttocoastam.com. Right at the top, it says Coast Insider. You can click that, and you can sign up. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're talking with Dr. Peter Bragan, author, Medication Madness. Peter, when we take calls, I'm sure we may get one or two or several of people who are on antidepressants, and they say it works for them. What do you say?
Well, I want to say two things. First, I don't want anybody suddenly stopping their antidepressants after listening to this show, because they're not only dangerous to start, they're very dangerous to stop abruptly. So if you're going to decide to come off your antidepressants, do it slowly, do it hopefully with good clinical supervision, let a dear friend know about it, so because you may not even realize that you're getting agitated or depressed as you withdraw. So withdrawal is also a problem. People who feel they've been helped by antidepressants, you know, I think that's a personal choice for them. I believe that the drugs can't have a direct effect on depression, because depression is psychological, spiritual, human experience. And the way the drugs work, usually over a period of time, is they blunt emotions. They provide a kind of an anesthesia. And then as that happens over the years of being on the drug, the individual doesn't realize what they have lost. That's very, very common. Another way the drugs work is by giving an artificial high.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually very temporary, and then comes this other apathy or indifference. So I would say that even if you feel these medications have helped you, beware being on them indefinitely. We have evidence of brain harm from these drugs in animal studies and in human studies. We have evidence of abnormal cell growth in the brain from these drugs. So in general, heavy exposure to psychoactive substances for years is not good for a person, and the person gets what I call medication spellbound. They don't really realize that they're not doing as well as they were before, that they don't have as much feeling, that they've lost their creativity, they're not as loving as they were. So I would say beware being on these drugs indefinitely. When your psychiatrist or your doctor tells you you should be on this for the rest of your life, remember that there are no rest of your life studies to base that conclusion on. And I think in general, if a person can eventually come off these meds, that's the best way to go. But to do it slowly and carefully and with really good clinical support, hopefully, and family and friend support.
But you would prefer, and as a psychiatrist, you don't even prescribe these anymore, do you?
No, I don't. I think that the things we usually prescribe these drugs for, in particular for depression or also for anxiety, are things that good psychotherapists can handle. And in serious cases, you work with the whole family and you develop family support for the child or husband and wife for each other. You can get grandparents involved. There are very positive therapeutic ways to help people, in particular when they're depressed. And in fact, depression is really a loss of hope. It's a feeling of being totally stymied, feeling you can't get anywhere with your life. And beyond that, you're just so down, you don't even know why you're down. Well, good therapy can help a person understand why they're down, help a person find more optimistic, positive, better approach to life, and definitely can have a better effect on preventing suicide, because these drugs increase the suicide rate. So the idea of, well, what do you do if the person's really suicidal? Well, actually, if a person's really suicidal, you have to be very cautious about putting them on antidepressants, because like the young man in the Canadian case,
yeah,
people frequently get suicidal on these drugs.
All right, to a whole list of phone calls for you. First of all, we'll go to Saskatchewan in Canada. Brent's with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Brent, go ahead.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I wish this doctor was my psychiatrist. I believe everything he says is dead on. I started antidepressants about 18 years ago. My first one was Prozac. Exactly what he says. I stayed sober, got worse. Medication was increased. So within 2 or 3 months, went on to Zoloft, went on to, I think, 6 different SSRIs. I ended with Paxil. I was on for 10 years. I finally weaned myself off. It took me 10 months. I had very major withdrawal from these pills. And I feel sorry for that boy in Winnipeg. From what I experienced was, when you do get agitated on these medications, it's a lot worse. And it is kind of a fake high. Like, it does numb your senses by 20 to 25%. And just like the doctor said, you lose your love, you lose your caring, you just get in that kind of mode. And I don't know, I started them again this year because of anxiety and depression, and I don't know, again, they're not really helping.
They're not helping. They're not helping, Peter. What does he do?
Have you ever had a good counseling experience?
Yes. Therapy. And no.
Mm-hmm.
Yes and no. I guess over 7 to 8 sessions with someone for an hour, you can't really describe a lot of what you went through. And again, once you are kind of, once you take these pills, you're looked at differently, and you got that stigma against you, and the psychiatrist always, too, has that way to look at you, not every psychiatrist, but, and I don't want to admit it, but actually this year I got really bad in the spring, and I don't know why, but the same thing, I had very ill feelings towards my mother, and that's exactly what I wanted to do, was get a knife and just, for some reason I wanted to blame her.
What held you back, though, Brent? Why didn't you do that?
Because that good part of me was saying that it's wrong, and I could fight it, but deep down there was other side of me that just wanted to do it. It's like I just had to get it out of my system. It's very, very disturbing feeling.
Peter, he's lucky he was able to fight it.
Yes. Now, are you saying you were on the medication again when that happened? Or was that without them?
Yeah, that was earlier this year. I started them again. And,
and that's when it started.
Restarting can be a real serious problem for people. Sometimes the brain reacts even more strongly the second or third time around. Well, I hope that you will try to find someone that you can really, really talk to. Somebody, and shop. It's like making a friend, you know. Call some therapists on the phone. And don't think psychiatrist. Psychiatrists are not trained anymore to do therapy. My colleagues are not trained in how to really genuinely help people.
Yeah, those days are gone, Peter, aren't they?
Yeah. A terrible misfortune.
Why do some people need a psychiatrist and other people don't? You know, and I mean, I've gone through my ups and downs in life. Everybody has. We're human beings. But I've never gone to a psychiatrist to solve my problems. I've solved them myself. Why are some people able to do that and other people can't?
Well, first of all, I think some of it is just plain choice, that some people really just want to get help by talking about their issues and talking about what they've been through and to get talking help, and a lot of other people don't. So I think a lot of it, George, is just choice. I don't necessarily think that the people who go for help are worse off than a lot of other people.
Okay.
But I think you're asking another question as well, which is, why do some people get more desperate than other people? And I think there's a couple of factors, and then I think there's a large unknown, to be honest with you. But certainly, childhood trauma, childhood abuse, childhood conflicts in the family are absolutely known to produce much higher rates of suffering later on. And that emotional suffering can get labeled bipolar disorder, anxiety, OCD, whatever it gets labeled. Nonetheless, it goes back to the feelings of helplessness and suffering generated in childhood. Now, certainly, if you go through horrific enough experiences in adulthood, wartime experiences, terrible losses, then that too can throw a person into a state where they feel they just can't handle their lives anymore. But when you really get to know people who are having a lot of trouble handling their lives, you really get to know them and talk to them, I always get the feeling of there, but for the grace of God go I, that if I'd been through all that stuff, I think I wouldn't be doing much better than this other human being.
Let's go to Karen in Los Angeles, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Karen.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Hello, Doctor. How are you tonight?
Hi.
Good.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to be on this marvelous show.
Isn't it a wonderful show? I just love it. George and Doctor, I wanted to tell you about what happened to me. I was on, what was it, Xanax. And I had a friend, and she came over to my house. She was looking in my refrigerator for some reason. I can't remember what. But I wanted to take a knife and cut her neck.
For no reason.
For no reason.
Not that there should be a reason. But...
Just because she was there.
Oh.
And I said to myself, what would it be like if I just took this knife and cut her across her neck? And I said, no, don't think so.
Did you really consider it, Karen, or just think about it?
I thought about it. It wasn't a conscious decision. It was just something I thought, wonder what would happen if. I knew damn well what would happen if. And I just thought to myself, maybe I should. And then the rest of me said, maybe you shouldn't. And it was just really, I was terrified of these thoughts. And it was just something that occurred like right out of the blue, you know. And I never thought I would have a thought like that in my life, but I did. Then I thought about my mom, who was mentally ill anyway, and it just, you know, it kind of creeped me out.
What do you attribute to the thoughts going away?
Hopefully my common sense, because I just thought to myself, maybe if I just went away for a while, and not to a hospital or anything, but just stayed away from her for a while, maybe these thoughts wouldn't come like that.
Peter, let me ask you, like Karen, how many people, or Brent, how many people, what's the percent of people who are on these antidepressants go through these things and have those kinds of thoughts? It sounds like it's pretty darn high.
Yeah, let me address the Xanax, because that's not an antidepressant. That's a benzodiazepine tranquilizer.
What's that for?
It's in the same group as Valium and Librium and Klonopin. It's a tranquilizer for the reduction of anxiety.
Is it a happy pill?
It's like a happy pill. It's like a drink of alcohol. But Xanax, and I make this point in Medication Madness, that the two groups of drugs that are most associated with violence are first the antidepressants, and then specifically Xanax. Karen, you might get some comfort from seeing in my book that Xanax does this to people. It disinhibits people. It gives rise to these unforeseen, disinhibited, outrageous feelings, and it has led to violence and murder. So,
jeez.
And also,
kids are buying Xanax, by the way, in schools. Did you know that from their friends?
There's a great increase also in its prescription recently, and it is absolutely the most dangerous of all the tranquilizing sedative kinds of drugs, because it's short-acting, it has a lot of punch, severe withdrawal problems. Coming off Xanax is even worse, can be even worse than coming off the antidepressants, and long-term effects are at least as bad. I mean, people, we have a lot of studies showing years and years on Xanax actually causes a deterioration in mental functioning. So again, if you're on these drugs for lifetime, you've been told that, relook at it. Get a second opinion, a third opinion. See if someone wants to help you in reducing your dose a little, see how that feels. But none of these drugs can you come off abruptly.
No. Is there something wrong with people genetically, hence they need to take antidepressants?
Well, of course, of course not. Of course, 100% not. There's nothing wrong in the brains of people who go to psychiatrists until they get there and they get a drug.
There's something wrong.
The whole thing of the
Unless you're a whacked-out serial killer or something like that.
Well, we don't have any evidence that, other than when given pharmacological agents, that people who get violent in the normal course of events are particularly different. Although some have head injuries, and head injuries like drugs, if you look at Murderer's Row, you're likely to find on it in a prison that most of the people there not only had child abuse and not only drug abuse, but also probably had a head injury. So,
physical, maybe somebody whacked them in the head a lot or something.
Yeah, yeah. So when you impair brain function, you risk dangerous, out-of-control reactions, and all psychiatric drugs impair brain function. There's no way around that.
Let's go to Austin, Texas. First-time caller. Hey, Rain, go ahead.
Hi there. How's it going?
Okay.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks.
All right. Well, I was just calling because I had experience with Lexapro. I was on it. I guess I ended up in treatment for alcoholism, and they diagnosed me with general anxiety disorder and moderate depression and put me on Lexapro. And it worked for about 3 months, you know, and it was pretty amazing, the difference, having the elimination of the anxiety. But after 3 months, like, so many things that I should have been feeling had kind of built up. And after 3 months, I ended up in the hospital because I tried to kill myself.
Oh, my gosh. Right.
Yeah. I'm not even working with doctors anymore. I just don't even really trust them. I'm just stepping myself down. I was at 20 milligrams. Now I'm down at 10. And I really, I actually cried the other day for not any particular reason, and it felt really good, you know. But I just feel like being on it, like, all the things that happened that built up inside of me that I knew I had feelings about, I just couldn't feel them, really affected me to a point that I had to kind of explode in order to feel.
What are your thoughts, your doctor?
Well, I think this is these callers and your honesty is just incredible. Anyone listening to this show now probably knows more about the risks of these drugs than the psychiatrist who's prescribing them, because you see how consistent these stories are, and yet psychiatrists are denying it. The loss of feeling is so commonly reported, and this notion of finally being able to cry again, I hear that frequently in my practice. You know, a man or woman loses their spouse and they're put on the drug that same day or the next day, and they never even go through a normal mourning period until they start to come off the medications. There's so much more that life can offer in the way of help to people who are suffering than just drugging them. And it's not just therapy. It's therapy, it's spirituality, religion, even exercise, simple exercise, proves to be at least as effective and far more healthy than antidepressants.
And what about sugar? Does that make people depressed?
I don't think so, other than if you got diabetes, because diabetes will make you depressed. I mean, the illnesses make people depressed. Or if you're taking a lot and your body doesn't react well and you go into a crash, you go into a hypoglycemic crash. But I don't think using sugar in general is going to be a mental health hazard.
All right, my friend. Thank you. Dr. Peter Bragan, his book, Medication Madness, The Role of Psychiatric Drugs in Cases of Violence, Suicide, and Crime. And you've just heard just a few of those stories that are out there. He's reacting, of course, to a story where he testified on behalf of a 16-year-old who stabbed his friend to death after being on Prozac. And a judge in Canada said, yep, it's the antidepressant that was the cause of the murder. Up next, two parts of a show with Paul Von Ward. First half, we're going to talk about the ET intervention, followed by reincarnation on Coast to Coast AM.